Blog
Global Cooling Radio.
Global Cooling Radio.
A production of ClimateGateCountryClub.com.
The world's largest networking site for skeptics.
Good morning and welcome to Global Cooling Radio. My name is Mark Gillar, and our very special guest today is Christopher Essex. Christopher is a professor and associate chair in the Department of Applied Mathematics at the University of Western Ontario, and he is the former director of its program for theoretical physics. He is also, along with Ross McKittrick, the co-author of Taken by Storm, The Troubled Science, Policy, and Politics of Global Warming. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Mark.
Glad to have you here. You know, it's been a busy couple of weeks in the area of global warming, especially due to the fact that we've had this explosion in a coal mine that killed over 20 people here in the United States. We've had an explosion at the base of a oil platform in the Gulf of Mexico. So this has sort of energized the global warming crowd. It's put a lot of emphasis behind why we need cap and trade in the United States. In fact, if you saw the kangaroo court thing that they set up this week, where they put, you know, a room full of alarmists against, you know, one skeptic, Lord Monckton, before Congress, the meeting was opened by Markey by referencing what went on with the coal mine and with the oil leak in the Gulf. So how do you see this affecting the argument on global warming? Do you see this as being something that's going to push through the cap-and-trade legislation in the United States and perhaps convince the United States and other countries that have been hesitant to sign a Kyoto-type agreement to go forward with it?
Well, I have my own spin on these things, but you know, you have to understand that I'm not a politician, and I come at this more from the science side of things. And I've been involved in this field off and on since the 1970s, and I built my first climate model in the 1970s. And so I look at these kinds of things as just kind of, you know, the political weather of the day. I think it comes and goes, and people always have excuses or reasons that seem to be compelling, but really they're just really emotional arguments that don't really hold together, in my view.
Now, you say you built your first computer model in the 1970s, so you
climate
actually
model.
Go
climate
back.
Computer model.
Climate model. I'm sorry, climate model in the 1970s.
Yeah.
So you actually go back to the time period when a lot of people believed in global cooling.
Oh, yeah. And I lived through all of that. And, when I started building climate models in those days, they didn't have quite the computer resources. You had to do a lot of things by hand. So you got into a lot of the underlying physics very directly, and you got to know where all of the, you know, floppy bits in the models are, and I didn't personally find it very satisfying, and I saw that a lot of more basic work needed to be done, and that kind of affected my career, and that's the direction I went into, and I keep getting drawn back into this stuff because of various reasons, and I keep trying to get out, and I keep getting pulled back in, you know, like the Godfather movie, you know. So, yeah.
Kind of like you try to get away, but it just keeps pulling you back.
Yeah, I get. Then I thought I was out, and then they pulled me back in. You know, I mean that's. So that's.
Well, I think you're kind of stuck for a while.
I have been hoping that people would, you know, get. Interested in something else, and then this would kind of peter out, but they just keep getting more and more excited about it, and I keep getting disappointed, but it will peter out eventually. People will lose interest and move on to something else.
Well, right now, do you think there's just too much money involved? Because, I mean, we've got companies like Goldman Sachs that stand to make a killing if carbon trading moves forward.
My co-author, Ross McKittrick, who, of course, was one of the guys who fought the original battles with the hockey stick, along with Steve McIntyre and so on, he's really the economist, and he would sort of have some really definite things to say about this. But my impression is, from reading what's going on, is a lot of this cap-and-trade stuff seems really weird to me, and the size of the market that's involved will completely dwarf the oil entire oil industry, as for my understanding, is that the amount of money that would be involved would just be colossal. And so there is just a tremendous amount of money and behind the idea of going ahead with this. So yeah, I think there's a lot of it has to do with that.
But I don't have mind
say about that. I mean, I could say about it, but you know, I can't really do anything about it. So it is what it is.
Well, with that in mind, do you find it a bit ironic that those who attack skeptics like yourself, in addition to going straight after one's credentials, also then try to connect the dots from a monetary standpoint? It seems like anyone who dares to disagree with, you know, the whole man-made global warming theory is accused of somehow being on the financial take from big coal or big oil or, you know, traditional energy industry.
It was socially acceptable to be skeptical in the 1980s about this. There was a very definite change in tone in the 1990s. And it became quite nasty and ferocious, which I didn't really understand. I mean, I didn't really understand how these people could think they were talking about the world of facts and they would care about whether someone was getting money from one place or another. And as you know, coming from a scientist's perspective, that's not the way it works. And you know, the arguments stand or fall on their own, not the person's reputation or implications about it. I mean, there's so many crazy things that are just accepted as part of the normal pattern nowadays. I think one of the Democrat talking heads was saying something I saw on I think it was CNN, and he was talking about the pollution lobby, which of course it just seems bizarre to me that a term, the pollution lobby, could actually make any sense to anybody. But there's enough. I mean, is anyone in favor of pollution? I mean, is there actually an organized group of people who are trying to create pollution? I mean, it doesn't make any sense at all, you know. But you can tell that the political atmosphere. The nature of the political atmosphere, the fact that someone who's a smart political operative would use language like that, and that would actually have some kind of traction in people's minds. I mean, so it's just the kind of craziness that has been going on for the past 20 years in this respect. And I think I've had a little bit more clarity on understanding how these tactics work. After the revelations about Saul Alinsky's rules for radicals, and I came to understand that that's the objective with this sort of thing. I mean, it's what's happening is completely and utterly foreign to science. This is nothing, has no connection whatsoever with the way in which scientists think. This idea that you go after people and talk about their connections to oil companies, and that I think is. Of course, I have absolutely no. The only connections to oil companies I have is when I fill up at the pump. You know, I mean, that's my connection to oil companies. You know, so I do have a connection to oil companies, but I don't. Yeah, you know, and so, but the implication and the desire is to make this connection. The idea that we'd be getting huge sums of money to be in favor of the end of the world. You see, the world is going to end, and you know, if you pay me some money, I'll say it isn't going to end. I mean, like, what kind of insanity is that? I mean, it's like, you know, I'll just, with all this money, I can just be satisfied that I, you know, when the world ends, I'll feel good. I mean, that doesn't make any sense at all. I mean, how can people even support that? I don't know. But that's the way political thinking works, and personally, I hate it, and it's just the way it is.
It certainly does seem to be the way it is right now, and perhaps
it's
one of the things
been that way. I think that's the way political thinking always works, and that's one of the reasons why scientists always are getting in trouble historically in this respect. They always run afoul of that because that's not the way you're supposed to think with science. You're supposed to try to, you know, shut out all that noise of, you know, the human interactions and try to listen to what the natural world is saying. And it's a completely different kind of language, and it's a different kind of pattern. It doesn't work the same way. So, you know, it's and once you start reporting on that, and you sort of suddenly deal with these experienced political operatives, it's a very strange world. You're just, everything is upside down and doesn't make any sense. Garbage.
Well, we're talking about the politicians, but in the wake of the ClimateGate scandal, it seems like there's certainly some scientists who've become comfortable with using political tactics against their opponents.
Oh, of course. I mean, scientists are human beings like anybody else, and they can get caught up in that. And one of the big problems is, you know, there's a very clear line between the two, and, you know, you can find yourself easily wandering over, you know, from one side to the other. I mean, you know, I gave a talk, a public talk on this in Chicago a couple of years back, and, you know, I just stuck to the science, and I just talked about the details and just how fundamentally demanding this field is scientifically. And people still at the end wanted to know what my political opinion was about the whole thing. So, I mean, people can't separate the two. I mean, they're very bad at separating the two because they don't spend a lot of time thinking scientifically. And, you know, the problem is that some of the scientists who do get into this, they get lost in the wilderness. They should leave a trail of breadcrumbs, perhaps, to find their way back afterwards. You know, they get lost, and sometimes you feel like, you know, you have to go out. Maybe we should go out in the wilderness and in the dark forest of politics, and, you know, call, go looking for James Hansen. James, it's time to come home. You know, I mean, something like that.
I've kind of been thinking of it from a Star Wars perspective. We need to pull them back from the dark side. But, you know,
I really love that T-shirt that says, come to the dark side. We have cookies.
And in this case, the dark side has a lot of money. I mean,
that's right.
And not only that, I mean, let's be honest about this. Fame is always, you know, a nice little perk as well. And we have some people that are probably at one point in their careers used to toiling away in a little cubicle at a university somewhere, and now all of a sudden they're on David Letterman and they're on CNN and they're getting all this publicity.
You really want to be on David Letterman and CNN? I don't. I mean, that's...
Well,
that's
James Hansen did.
Well, I mean, look, they're different kinds of people, but, I mean, this kind of thing doesn't appeal to me at all, so... I don't consider that to be a perk. You know, the thing is, sometimes science, I mean, the scientists aren't all alike. I mean, not just individually, but in terms of their fields. There's very many different kinds of personalities in different fields. And, I mean, you've heard about the mathematician Gregory Perelman, who recently turned down a $1 million prize, wasn't interested. So, I mean, people
wow.
are...
Yeah.
Well, it's a famous story. It was widely reported recently, but he solved one of the Cayley Millennium problems, and he was offered the Fields Medal, which is like the Nobel Prize in Mathematics, and he said, no, not interested. You know, he solved this, you know, big problem. The Cayley Millennium problems are these, like, seven problems that... have been established, each with a $1 million prize, as, you know, the, you know, some of the most basic and pressing unsolved problems in mathematics that generations have worked on to try to crack, and they haven't accomplished it. So he just said, well, no, I'm not interested in the Fields Medal. And then recently the Clay Mathematics Institute said, yeah, he has succeeded, and we'll give him $1 million. And he said, no, not interested.
So, wow.
Yeah.
A true scientist.
Well, yeah, I mean, the thing is, they're motivated by different things. And, I mean, I think what happens in the scientific world is that it's not just about money. It's also about, you know, recognition and prestige and all those things that, you know, are part of it. And so some people, that goes with the size of the research grants you get, and so people have a kind of vested interest in trying to make sure that their work is recognized and they have a legacy. And, I mean, all those kind of very human things that can happen. I don't say that that's the whole story. I mean, I think there are a lot of people who are concerned about this who are very credible and, you know, scientists who really believe this. But usually with those people who are also credible, if I have dinner with them or something, they'll agree with some of the problems that I see with it. But they'll say, nonetheless, I still think it's an issue. So... I can live with that, you know, and so that's fine. But if they kind of take the position that, you know, now you're some kind of, you know, spawn of the devil because you have an alternative viewpoint or a different viewpoint to them, then, of course, then we're no longer in the world of science. But scientists can sit across from the table and disagree with each other, and that's the way it's supposed to be.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think right here in Texas, not very far away from me at a major university, there's someone who will say one thing privately and then another thing publicly about this particular issue. We have a caller on the line for you. It is Leighton Stewart of Boerne, Texas, and let's see if we can bring Stewart on, Leighton online. Leighton, can you hear us?
Hey, Mark, I can hear you loud and clear.
Fantastic. What's your question for Christopher this morning?
Hey, Christopher. Listen,
hi.
I haven't read your book yet, but I promise you I will.
Oh, good.
I was interested in your comments on, you know, who's making money off of this, and we know who's making money off of it. Wall Street, the green industries, the administration will make a lot of tax money and buy votes with it, academia. Environmental extremist groups obviously use it to raise money.
Yeah,
my
I
question,
call those
my
guys free enterprise politicians.
Yeah, hello. my question is, do you know where there is a good summary of, you know, what all the utilities and some of the marketers, why they've all jumped on this bandwagon of backing cap and trade, just so we can advertise to the public that, hey, these companies are backing this because they're all going to make money off of it.
Well, I've read,
you know, the
a few things about
Exelon's.
I'm not an expert on cap and trade, but and so I warn you about that. So, you know, but that doesn't stop me sometimes from talking about what I don't know what I'm talking about. But my understanding is that the way cap and trade works is they have an agency that creates these certificates for talking about what you made, that you didn't make, that you intended to make, and then they have exchange agencies, and they're taking commissions, and this whole thing ends up being a huge amount of money. So
I understand that. My question was, I'm looking for, trying to figure out a list of all of these different utilities and people that are obviously going to make money if cap and trade comes in. And then the public can figure out, well, when they see advertising coming from these guys to back cap and trade, they'll say, sure, they're doing it because it's going to line their pockets. And that was the
end. Yeah, that would be a good thing for you to have, but I'm not an expert on that. So
okay, good. Well, I'm sorry. I just wanted to ask you that. The other observation I'd make on talking about the dark side is a lot of the environmentalists out there don't realize what they're really going to do if they actually succeed in ultimately lowering the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, because one thing they'll do is they will brown the earth. They don't realize that these days, but as CO2 comes out of the atmosphere, the plants will not grow as much.
Let me assure you about something, and this is just sort of, I'm trying to now speak as the voice of reality. It's not going to happen. The CO2 is not going to come down. Doesn't matter what they do. I mean, it's not going to happen. It's just going to continue to go up. Because if you look at the actual performance that Kyoto Accord was supposed to do, if everyone was a good boy and did exactly what the Kyoto Accord was supposed to do, which no one has succeeded at, the amount of change that would be involved would be negligible. So everyone just completely closed down on things. There's hardly any change in the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere as a result of these policies.
Actually,
I don't have any expectation that the amount of CO2 is going to come down despite all of these draconian sort of things that people are talking about. And no one's going to actually allow their economies to be crushed to the magnitude that would have to be carried out in order to have that happen. So
when you say no, and I would agree that the entire rest of the world will feel that way, but I'm a little bit concerned about our own government.
Well, I don't blame you. I understand that, and we're all holding our breath about what's happening for you in the United States because it affects us all.
Hello. Okay.
Yeah. So we wish you well with that.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
And Leighton, I would suggest that perhaps you contact Joanne Nova in Australia, and she's been doing a good job of trying to track the climate money, and that might be a good place for you to start. And what I can do is after the show, I can get in touch with you. I've got your phone number here, and we can try to put you in touch.
Yeah, I have Joanne's information.
Okay, excellent.
I'm looking forward to, I don't know if Joanne's going to be at this fourth International Climate Conference in Chicago, but I'm hoping she is, because I'd like to.
Actually, she has said she will not be able to make it.
Oh, okay, that's too bad. Yep.
Yeah,
I actually will be making a presentation at that conference.
Oh, good for
so,
you.
Yeah.
Oh, well, what's your presentation on? Just out of curiosity, what's your presentation
on?
It'll
be on the benefits of more carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, and also all of the empirical evidence that disproves all these models. unbelievable, you know, what they've come out with. They are just absolutely ignoring all of the paleoclimate history on Earth that clearly does not show that we have ever had runaway global warming. So when they try to kick in with, you know, positive feedback and things like that, since they got whacked upside the head with finding out that the carbon dioxide was following the temperature changes, that's all they've come back with. But I can't find anything in the climate history looking back 540 million years that shows that we've ever had runaway global warming, even when CO2 levels were at 7,000 parts per million. So anyway, that's what I'll be talking about, are those two subjects.
Hmm.
I think you're trying to inject way too much common sense into this, Leighton.
No, I know it. But I have found out that with the audiences can understand the benefits of CO2 to plants, because everybody learned that in grade school. And you can kind of get their attention with that. And then the last thing they say is, oh, but it causes global warming. At which point, depending on the audience, I can say, you know, well, let me talk about that, or like heck it does. And
well,
you kind of get your foot in the door
person,
to talk.
Leighton, since you're a CO2 person, you notice that they don't say CO2, they say carbon.
Well, they're going to say
anything. I mean, the physics is completely altered by that one shorthand.
Well, that is true, but it's not the first alteration they've made.
Well, of course,
it used to be global warming.
I've had to live with that,
yeah.
But I mean, since we're talking about carbon dioxide, people keep talking about the carbon budget, but what does the carbon budget have to do? It's the carbon dioxide budget, because the vibration rotation spectrum of that molecule, the actual vibration of the oxygen, the thing bending and twisting at the same time, that's what causes this. So they tend to end up demonizing carbon itself, and I actually have examples where people, actually a well-known environmentalist here in Canada, was saying that the reason why cars are hot on a sunny day is because of the carbon in the glass. You know, of course, it's... I know.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah. So,
and that's what we're all made of. We're all made of carbon.
It's absolutely nothing wrong with carbon. And so it's a very specific kind of physics, and of course that's really what my issue or my role here in this discussion is, really to try to talk about the scientific side of things as opposed to the economic side of things.
If I can share a quick story
thank
with you.
You
guys, that thank you, Leighton. If I can share a quick story with you guys that illustrates this point, is that a well-known skeptic in the United States was scheduled to be on a very, very popular U.S. television show, and the very first question that they were asked, if you can believe this, is, okay, well, if carbon dioxide is so great, then how come people who want to kill themselves will pull into their garage with their car and close the door and turn the car on and kill themselves with carbon dioxide?
And, of course, the physics of carbon monoxide is completely different. I mean, the chemistry is different. The radiation properties are completely different. And, you know, I mean, the point I guess I'm trying to lead up to here is that there are times when you can blow off the science and say, well, you know, that's just for, you know, scientists, you know, special, crazy, talking science stuff. But sometimes the scientific technicalities matter. And this is one of the subjects where the technicalities do matter, and somehow we're able to kind of constantly escape from facing them. I mean, and I've been seeing this for 20 years. I mean, I've been in this for a long, long time. And there are certain kinds of repetitive distortions that just keep going on and on and on, and they're uncorrectable. It's not that people have the wrong idea and then it gets corrected. It never gets corrected. And so we sort of continually deal with these grade school metaphors that are wrong, you know, and so people don't understand even what the issues are. from a scientific point of view, never mind from the all the other issues, which are all equally important.
I have received hate mail in the past from people who say, take down your website, shut down that radio show, all you're doing is harming the planet, and you know, they go on and on and on about carbon, and I will send them back a list, and I probably could make that list better by talking with Leighton, but I will send them back a list of all the benefits of CO2, and I'll get a response something like this: well, I don't know anything about CO2, but all I know is you people are trying to pollute the world. And, you know, if you're going to get a response like that from somebody who doesn't understand the difference between carbon monoxide and carbon dioxide, I mean, where do you begin to reason with them? Because in their mind,
the point is that this is not in the domain of reason. Very little of this is. When you hear people talking about this being science and the science is settled, et cetera, and nobody knows what's settled. There's a consensus. I mean, all you have to do is ask a question, a consensus about what? You just answer me that question. Just say, what did they agree to? And then usually they kind of, they have never really thought about it. A consensus by whom? Do you know anybody on this list of people who, I mean, they don't. I mean, this is just a political pattern, just like this thing I was telling you about the pollution lobby. I mean, we're not talking about anything in the realm of rational discussion here. I mean, there isn't such a thing as a pollution lobby. Nobody's in favor of pollution. So, I mean, it's the same thing here. I mean, the consensus, well, if you actually, I mean, one of the things I usually like to do is put up a quotation in the beginning of a lecture I give on this, and I say, well, you know, this is a really radical quotation. I mean, it's really super skeptical. It says we'll never be able to forecast climate because of the nonlinear dynamics involved and so on. And it's a very brazen kind of thing. And I said, well, if you were to go out in certain circles and say that, you would be considered to be a climate denier or something like that. You would be violating the consensus position. Well, then I reveal to the audience, you know, this is the source. It's from the third assessment report of the IPCC. So this is the consensus position, right? So they don't even know what they're talking about, what the consensus is. I mean, they're saying it's right in the IPCC saying that they will never be able to forecast climate. Of course, that's not in the political summary, which is on the front, which is called the Summary for Policymakers, for the Panel of the United Nations, PUN for short. You know, the other one we call SPAM. But anyway, that's but the main this is the
that.
Main body, the main body of the report. So people don't even know what they're talking about, but they feel very strongly about it anyway. That's politics. That's not science.
Gotcha. Well, we have about 2 minutes left, so if for the listeners out there who don't want to be as ignorant on this subject as most of us are, and I sense some of perhaps the frustration with society not being scientifically prepared enough to deal with this issue, where would you suggest, what would be a good starting point for the average listener, or even someone like myself who doesn't really have a scientific background, and we want to try to educate ourselves so that we can be more informed on this and better able to interpret it?
Well, it's that particular issue that caused myself and Ross McKittrick to write our book, Taken by Storm, which was published in 2002. So we're kind of the granddaddy of all of these, because that was back in the days when nobody was publicly talking about this stuff. So myself and Ross got into a lot of trouble over this. I mean, I bet you did. I was even denounced in Parliament, in Parliament of Canada. Some guy denounced me.
Wow.
and of course Ross got involved with Steve McIntyre, and they ended up taking it all the way to the U.S. Congress, as you recall. And of course the second edition is the definitive story of the hockey stick. You can read about that. But anyway, so that's why we wrote Taken by Storm, was so that people who are, you know, there are a lot of smart people around who just don't know what the sort of details are. We give you the details you need in order to understand the physics and the science and to some extent the politics of what's going on. There have been a lot of more recent books that have come out, and they're, you know, I think you should try to read those too. Yeah. So and read the skeptical books. Don't read the ones that, you know, in the category of, oh my God, we're all going to die, and there's other titles along those lines. I mean, those things have got enough play, and they don't really need to be read anymore. So
well, if someone will come to my site, thehooterville.com, and click on the books/links tab, we have a lot of the more recent books there. Very quickly, we are going to sign off our official time. I want to thank our listeners for being with us. Leighton, thanks for calling in. Chris, thank you for being here, and we're going to head into bonus footage.
Okay.
Global Cooling Radio.
Global Cooling Radio.
A production of ClimateGateCountryClub.com.
The world's largest networking site for skeptics.
Okay, we are off the air but still recording, and listeners who listen to this via RSS feed or through their iTunes subscription to Global Cooling Radio will be hearing all of this. And again, that is the bulk of our listenership. So,
okay.
Chris, can you hang on for a few more minutes?
Yep.
All right, fantastic. Leighton, are you still there?
I am still here.
Fantastic.
Way to go,
Mark. Hey, thank you for hanging on. I'm still new at this, but we're trying to give you guys a voice. We talk about the fact that the hockey stick is pretty much broken. Chris, I'm just curious, what's your take on the perception of the global community as to whether or not the hockey stick is really broken? Because there's a site on the science blogs, it's called the Deltoid blog, where all the alarmists go. And if you listen to these guys, I heard someone laugh. If you listen to these guys, the hockey stick had a couple of problems. Michael Mann addressed that, and the issue is over. The hockey stick is not broken. It's been proven time and time again. Other people have substantiated his work. A couple of minor problems, but they've been looked at, they've been addressed, and there really isn't an issue with the hockey stick anymore.
Well, I don't know why the hockey stick was of ever any interest at all, but personally, it never really gave me much of a buzz. I never got really excited about that from a scientific point of view, but it was very much a prop that was extremely useful for the sort of political side of the discussion. And I think that's why it became so famous, not because...
Well, it got rid of the Little Ice Age and the medieval warm period.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's some other problems I think are more fundamental with it. I mean, in Taken by Storm, one of the things we did is we used similar techniques to... we found out the U.S. GDP using tree rings back to the year 1000. So surprisingly, the U.S. GDP behaves also like a hockey stick, and you'd be amazed. You know? So we also did the same kind of technique, and with because people started to say, well, maybe there is some kind of effect of U.S. GDP. So then we did the same thing again with the German Consumer Price Index back to the year 1000 using tree rings. And the technique as a mathematical technique is extremely limited, and it's very flawed. And we talk about it extensively in the book, why it doesn't actually necessarily mean anything like what it's supposed to mean. Mm-hmm. That said, and that's one of the reasons why I objected to it in principle from the very beginning, but Ross McKittrick and Steve McIntyre were very curious about how they actually did it within the framework of what it is. They're within the framework of their own rules, and so I saw early drafts of the papers that they wrote, which led to the big blowout about the hockey stick, and I commented on them. And in fact, I probably, if I wanted to, I could have been on it, but I didn't want to be on those papers because I didn't think in principle that I thought they had any fundamental scientific merit. That was my opinion, my scientific opinion. But of course, you know that was what finally broke them. So these things are, it's an extremely problematic technique, and the various efforts to supposedly fix it, we know why they want it fixed, because it just becomes such a useful tool for making it sound like, you know, there's something remarkable happened in recent times. And I just don't really see that this technique can actually bring that out in a very convincing way.
Well, I think, as we've talked about, the scientific lack of ability on the part of society, at least here in the United States, anyone can look at that graph and say, whoa, look at that. They're right. Look at that. You know, and you look at that and you go, man, we're going off the charts. I mean, if we keep going like this, we're going to...
As I said, U.S. GDP looks almost...
There are also some questions.
You can actually get temperatures before Galileo invented the thermometer. Amazing, don't you think? You know.
That is. Of course, you know, Galileo.
In the time of Eric the Red, we don't have temperatures for the whole Earth. You know, do you really believe that? No, I don't.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of the temperature of the Earth, is it even correct to try to ask the Earth to open its mouth, say off, stick in a thermometer, and get a global temperature, especially
with
this?
Well, this was a really controversial thing that Ross and I wrote about in the first edition. And you know, it's one of those things that if you talk to a physicist, you just have to say, well, the system is not in thermodynamic equilibrium, so it doesn't have a temperature, and there was, you know, they'll say, oh, yeah, well, isn't that obvious? But in the meteorological world, people think a little differently, and they kind of tend to think of this average as a temperature, even though they don't really mean that. And at least the good meteorologists don't. They said, well, it's sort of an index of some kind. But if it's not a temperature, then if it goes up, can you really say that that amounts to warming? If it's just an index, does it mean as it goes up it's indexing? I mean, what does that mean? Well, it's de-indexing. I mean, if it's not really a temperature. But of course, there are people who don't understand that if you average a bunch of temperatures together, it doesn't give you a temperature in a non-equilibrium system. But I mean, basically, they want to use this statistic, which is not actually a temperature, to be the internal cause of all kinds of insane kinds of things, you know, like the population of kittens changing and things like that, you know. And, you know, I mean, there's a website that tells you all the things and all the news links of all the possible things that people believe or can be blamed on the change in this particular statistic, and it's a pretty funny reading. You can look it up. And kittens
it's,
was
it's the number watch.
Yeah.
It's the number watch. In the UK, and what I've done, because a lot of those links are actually dead now, is I have, if you go to my site on the front page, it says there's this big byline that says it's official, everything bad is caused by global warming, and not wanting to take anything away from them, I I do give them credit for being the place that I took a lot of those, but what I've done is I've taken those, I've updated the links, and I've put the ones that are diametrically opposed to each other right beside each other.
Well, that's a good idea. I'm glad you did that. I think people have to understand just how silly that is. But from the point of view of the physics, that trends in that statistic, there's no physical argument. I can't look at it. No one provides a bunch of equations that say that now affects the local conditions in any way. There's no physics behind that. I mean, they use a lot of physics to generate that average, but they don't take that thing and turn back and say, well, that leads to droughts or leads to, I mean, it's not clear at all how that actually causes things. And of course, they'll say, well, they look at a model or something like that. But models are staggeringly limited. They're if you're really experienced, you might be able to say some things about things, but it's a very, very, very tricky thing to say anything really coherent with these kinds of models. So it's a, I don't think that they really can say what it means. But if you think about it from a mathematical point of view, if, for example, you're in Paris and you want to say, well, global warming is affecting Paris in some way. I mean, I'm just choosing Paris as an example. If you look at the mathematical expression, this statistic depends mathematically not just on the conditions in Paris, but also on the conditions on all the measuring sites all over the world. So it doesn't just depend on them. So, for instance, it depends upon the conditions in Miami. So you know, it's not just conditions in Paris that determine whether global warming is affecting Paris, but also the conditions in Miami. And even more, which I think is even funnier, is that they work with statistical anomalies. So they take an average against the past 30 years. So they compare how they're doing against the past 30 years. So what happens in Paris now doesn't just depend on Miami, but it also depends on what happened in Miami 20 years ago. So mathematically. So if you say things are melting in Paris, it's like saying that the ice cubes in my refrigerator are melting because Mike down the street lit his barbecue last summer. So this is not a temperature. It's not a temperature. It's not a physical temperature. It's a statistic. And the burden on the people who push this thing is to prove that it has merit in its own right. Now, I ended up writing a paper with a couple of colleagues, a thermodynamicist in Copenhagen, myself, and my co-author, Ross McKittrick. And we wrote this paper on global temperatures because people kept asking about this. So we put it into the Journal of Non-Equilibrium Thermodynamics, and we basically went through and dealt with all of the issues that people raised about it and many misunderstandings that people have about the thermodynamics of this thing. And it just doesn't work. It's just not a temperature, and the whole premise of warming is a problem. That doesn't mean that climate can't change or anything like that. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that this thing is a temperature is a problematic thing.
Well, and of course, the other thing is all these warmists argue about the warming, that still doesn't prove that CO2 emissions by mankind is the reason behind it. And that's one of the other big issues, is that oftentimes people are arguing whether or not it's warmed, but the issue isn't whether or not we've had warming from time to time. Of course we have. It's whether or not the CO2 has led to that warming.
Well, I mean, the whole causal chain here is very rickety, and it's a long – anytime you have a long chain of arguments to develop or make a point, and there really is a lot of things that have to be all lined up in place, all your ducks have to be in a row before this actually makes any sense, you're already in a lot of trouble in terms of having a solid scientific argument. But the problem really is a very basic one in terms of what we actually mean by climate itself. I mean, we have this geological evidence, and we have all these kinds of proxies for what it is we're talking about, but from a rigorous mathematical point of view or a physical point of view, we aren't even sure what we mean by that. I mean, to give you an example, to characterize what I'm saying, if you step outside your door and you see a gust of wind kicking up some dust and so forth, you know, have a little blast of air across your face and a little spatter of rain and so forth. These things are momentary changes that happen on your personal size scale and on time scales of a few minutes. But what's going on in the atmosphere and oceans and in the surrounding universe are things that are changing all the time on every time scale, from meters to kilometers, or yards to miles to continents, right? I mean, and on time scales of seconds to years to all these time scales are all happening all at the same time. It's like a giant tumult, you know. I mean, it's just roaring at you. And the real challenge we have is what part of that change is climate and what part isn't? What part can we ditch and what can we keep? And there aren't any answers to those questions that are rigorous at all. They're just kind of customs and averaging and sort of, well, we'll kind of do it this way and we'll kind of do it that way. And if you do it in a different way, you get a slightly different answer. And, you know, it's not as solid as other kinds of science. So if we don't have the climate nailed down, we don't even know what we're talking about with climate. We can't talk about what climate change is. And that's the dilemma. So just because you take an average in a certain way and you watch it go up and down and jiggle up and back and forth, it doesn't mean that you've really grasped what climate change is all about. That said, that doesn't mean that there isn't such a thing, but this is still really a basic kind of issue, and I don't think anyone has solved it.
It certainly doesn't seem so, and I know you said you're getting tired of the fight. You wish it would just all go away.
I love hate kind of thing, you know.
I hate to disappoint you, but I think you're going to be stuck with this for a while. I think you're going to continue to have people call you and bug you and ask you to do interviews, and I think your opinion on this is going to be important for a long time. I don't think it's going to go away. I think, unfortunately, there's an old saying, follow the money, and, you know, I know this isn't your side of the deal, but as long as there's money to be made in trading carbon credits, as long as there's money to be made from retrofitting houses with, you know, more energy-efficient appliances, you're going to have the GEs of the world getting on board, and there's just so much money to be made by so many people in this. I can't imagine for one moment that the other side's going to go down without a fight. And as you said, you've been involved for 20 years, or longer, I guess.
Longer.
Yeah, longer than that.
Let me say that that one of the things that if people are really interested and very concerned about climate and so forth, what they should really do is make a decision right now. And the sort of simple principle, it's called hands off the scientists. You can have your political debate, you can argue and try to make your money and everything, but leave the scientists alone. I mean, if you think about it from a scientific point of view, there's an ecological kind of analogy I can give you. If you think of scientific ideas as a herd, you know, running on the savannah someplace, The skeptics for scientific ideas are like the big cats, the predators. And what they do is they take down the weak and they take down the sick, so it keeps the health of the herd high and the survivability of the herd in place. But what's happened is we've had these kind of political interventions backflow into the scientific world that has deliberate attempts to try to control and limit the involvement of skepticism in this field. So the big cats basically have been kept away from the herd, and the result is that the herd has gotten kind of weak and diseased and not healthy at all. There's lots of screwball ideas out there, and there's no big cats to take them down and remove them from the herd. You know, I mean, that's the problem, is that by doing what they're doing in order to win their political points, they're damaging the ability of the science in the long run to actually make progress in these fields. And I dare say that the scientific community or this progress of science in this field has very much slowed, if not stopped, because we're trying to produce this product for policymakers rather than trying to just solve the problem.
I would are you still there?
Sure. We are, Leighton. Go ahead.
The polls are getting better. I'm getting a little optimistic about that, and there are a lot of reasons for that, not the least of which is what you two guys are doing continuously. And I praise you for that. I'm just a dumb old geologist, and I'm trying to communicate with the public more at the non-scientific level, which is why I wrote my book, Fire, Ice, and Paradise, which was aimed at the non-scientist. But anyway, I think the public is slowly coming around, and if we can get enough of them on our side, we will eventually have some sway with the politicians. So keep up the good work of what you guys are doing. I look forward to following both of your trails. Mark, are you going to the Chicago conference?
I am sorry I will not be there either.
You won't either. I went last year, and that hooked me forever because all of these guys from all over the world are available and very accessible, which really almost surprised me. Everybody's
concerned
about that.
I was at the one before in New York.
I was there last March in New York a year ago.
Yeah, okay, I was there. I was speaking there.
Yeah, right. Well, Anyway, I thought it was a great conference, and I look forward to this one. Thank you guys very much. Listen, if you want information on what CO2 can do for the atmosphere, go to our website. It's plantsneedco2.org.
Tell you what, Leighton, I didn't know you had that, and I will put that on my list of recommended links on the HootervilleGazette.com.
Okay, good deal.
We'll do our best to promote it for you.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks for calling in today, Leighton.
Talk to you guys later.
Mm-hmm. Oh, fantastic. You know, he mentioned, Chris, that he was a geologist. You're a mathematician. And what's interesting is that we hear this thing thrown around all the time, you know, don't listen to this person. They're not a climatologist. Don't listen to that person. They're not a climatologist. Okay. Is it a little bit presumptuous to be talking about who is and who isn't a climatologist, given the relatively...
Yeah, well, that presumptuousness doesn't stop anybody. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, the problem is that there are very few people who actually have quotation marks training in so-called climatology. I mean, there are lots of different fields that have to be dealt with in this subject, and they're the one unifying property of all of them is mathematics. So I've had my nose in a lot of it over the years. I was part of a big modeling group for a couple of years when I was a postdoc many years ago, and so I kind of know about that side of it probably more than many people do, or more than they might expect if someone says I was a mathematician. But I'm not really concerned if people say, oh, he's a mathematician, so therefore, da-da-da-da. That's just nonsense.
I would agree with you. It's just one of the many things that gets thrown at the skeptic side. Well, Chris, I really appreciate you for being here today. I took a lot more of your time than I said I was going to, but I think it's been very valuable for – I tend to do that. It's been very valuable for our listeners. The book, Taken by Storm, The Troubled Science, Policy, and Politics of Global Warming,
it's the original. It was before all the other ones, or at least most of the other ones. So.
So if James Hansen is the granddaddy of global warming, you and Ross are the granddaddies of skeptics.
Well, maybe not the granddaddies, but maybe the daddies. There are probably some. I would say I know some granddaddies who are sort of before us even. But certainly we've been out in the field fighting this for longer than most.
Absolutely, and for anyone who might be saying, read a book by a guy who's a professor of applied mathematics, I don't know. This is a funny book. It actually is. I don't know how you did it, but you managed to inject humor.
There are no equations in it, none. And there's a one-act play, and there are cartoons.
And you know what? He's not lying. There actually are. So the Igor one I love. But the bottom line is it's a funny book, and you've obviously taken some steps to make it a little easier for the average individual like myself, so thank you for that. You can order the book right now by clicking on that picture of your screen. If you look down, for the listeners, Taken by Storm, just click on that. It'll take you directly to Amazon.com where you can order this very good book. Chris, once again, thanks for being here, and keep up the fight, my friend. I know you're tired, but we need you to keep fighting.
Okay. As I said, it's a love-hate thing, you know.
Absolutely. Once again, thanks for being here, and hopefully we can have you back soon.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.